Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. American journalists Laura Ling and Yuna Lee landed on American soil this morning, their long ordeal in North Korea finally over. A teary Ms. Ling went before the microphones in a hangar at the Burbank Airport and described what it was like to be marched into a room in Pyongyang by government officials and to realize they were about to be released.
We saw standing before us President Bill Clinton. We were shocked, but we knew instantly in our hearts that the nightmare of our lives was finally coming to an end.
In the end, getting the American journalists freed was the easy part. The real work, the hard diplomacy, continues. This hour on Point, Clinton's mission to Pyongyang and what it means for the U.S., North Korea, and what it says about how the Obama administration is handling a world full of problems. You can join the conversation. What do you see in the photos of Bill Clinton side by side with North Korea's Kim Jong-il? An important humanitarian mission or a propaganda coup for the North? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Seoul, South Korea, is Evan Romstad, Korea correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Evan, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jay. Nice to be here.
Thank you. What are the headlines today where you are? How is the news of the release of Laura Ling and Yuna Lee being received in South Korea and generally in the region?
Well, in South Korea, you know, it was the top story, of course. South Korean media and South Korean diplomats, of course, tend to look at this through the prism of their own political issues with North Korea. And so South Korea has one person who's been detained by North Korea since late March, a man who worked on the joint industrial project that the two countries have in the city of Kaesong. They have had no contact with North Korea on that guy. And then last week, a group of four fishermen were taken because they apparently crossed the line in the Sea of Japan, the East Sea as it's known here. And so South Korea currently has five people now detained by North Korea. And so the South Korean media was kind of looking at this issue through that prism. Mm. More interestingly, we got word today of how the North Korean media played all of this. Mm. And the nation's biggest newspaper is called Rodong Sinmun, and it's the paper of the ruling Workers' Party. And they did something rather unusual. They had five large pictures of President Clinton and Kim Jong-il together on the front page of the paper. It was just a small story on the front page, and the story did not mention the two reporters at all. Inside the paper, there was a small story that mentioned that the two reporters were leaving, but it did not connect the reporters to President Clinton's visit.
Well, there was a news release by North Korea also, which said that former President Clinton had long and wide-ranging discussions with North Korean officials, suggesting that there was more on the agenda than the two journalists. Do you have a sense of the parameters that were set for Mr. Clinton's mission? Were broader issues discussed beyond the release of the American women?
Well, we haven't heard exactly what was discussed yet, but the of course, it's very likely that many things were discussed. We know that he met with Kim Jong-il for more than 3 hours. About 2 hours of that was in a dinner, so that might have been a little bit less formal. But there was a formal meeting that lasted for an hour and 15 minutes or so, and it's certain that they talked about some more things than that. But what the U.S. has been careful to say is that President Clinton did not have any kind of official authority to negotiate or do anything like that. So anything he might have said would just have been his own opinion. Of course, he has very strong opinions, and he had negotiations of his own with North Korea back when he was president. And perhaps he and Kim Jong-il talked about those times a little bit.
Mm. Did we learn anything about the health of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, because of Mr. Clinton's trip or possibly anything related to the issues of succession in North Korea generally? I know that's a bit of a parlor game looking ahead, but what do you see?
Well, in regard to health, he did look better than he has in images and videos that we have seen in recent months. The pictures of him with Mr. Clinton showed him smiling and just, you know, looking very clean and fresh and everything. Whereas often the images that we see lately, and it may just be the quality of the media that's there or something like that, it's hard to really know, have not looked, had him looking so robust and such. We did not learn anything about succession. There were no signs of any of the two of his three sons who live in North Korea being involved in this affair at all.
Well, Evan Ramstad, Korea correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
I'd like to welcome now Brian Myers. He's joining us from Busan, South Korea. He heads up the International Studies Department at Dongsa University in Busan and is an expert on North Korean ideology and propaganda. He's the author of a forthcoming book on North Korean propaganda called The Cleanest Race. Welcome to the program, Brian Myers.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
How are you reading the headlines this morning about this story now that the U.S. women are back home on U.S. soil?
Well, you know, you raised at the top of the hour the question whether this is a humanitarian success or a propaganda coup for the North Koreans, and I think it's both, obviously. This comes at just the right time for the North Korean regime, right in the middle of a so-called speed battle in the course of which it's trying to intensify the people's pride in their regime. The Clinton visit is especially important because ever since the underground nuclear test in 2006, the North Koreans have been claiming that their accession to the nuclear club has drastically upgraded the country's image in the rest of the world, and yet they haven't had a high-ranking visitor from the United States with which to lend weight to this claim, and now they finally have that.
Mm. You use the word propaganda coup. I know many people are saying that North Korea would only make a deal with the U.S. to release American women in this manner if they expect to get something in return. Do you agree with that, and if so, what might that be?
Well, I think they've already got that something in return. I think we underestimate the extent to which this is a country that really is running on pride right now. If they were particularly interested in cash or in aid deals, they would not have been engaging in the sort of behavior they've been engaging in for the past few months. This is a country, really, which now derives almost its entire legitimacy from triumphalist antagonism with the United States. It needs to show its people on a regular basis that even though North Korea is much poorer than South Korea, it is by far the more respected of the two Koreas. Mm-hmm. So simply by having a former president arrive to Pyongyang on a tributary visit, and as you heard from Evan Ramstad, that is how this is being portrayed in the North Korean media already. I think that's more than enough in return for two journalists who really are not much use anymore to North Korea anyway.
Mr. Clinton's visit comes at a time when the North Koreans have defied a UN Security Council resolution, conducted nuclear testing, test-fired ballistic missiles. Is this any indication, Brian Myers, that North Korea may want to begin calming that down and even beginning bilateral talks of some sort?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, these supposed breakthroughs, we've had so many of them now. We had, the Philharmonic visit to Pyongyang last year. We had the February 13th agreement the year before that. We had the six-party talk joint agreement in September 2005, all the way back to the agreed framework in 1994. And they were all touted in America with great fanfare as marking a possible thaw in relations, and yet they led precisely nowhere. It's, you know, American optimism springs eternal. But these breakthroughs or these, you know, perceived breakthroughs are necessary for North Korea because it is no more interested in all-out warfare than it is interested in all-out peace. So it needs to take a step back every now and then.
So North Korea needs to keep this us versus them mentality. The minute they start cooperating, you say they lose their standing.
Exactly, because this is really, you know, the only reason that they have to exist. The one thing that I find very regrettable about the coverage of this whole incident is that not a single word has been said in the American media about the North Koreans' ideology or belief system. It's as if, you know, the North Koreans are just sitting there waiting for Americans to come and shape their way of thinking. But that's not the case. You know, since the North Korean economy collapsed in the mid-1990s, the only source of the regime's legitimacy has been the military and the nuclear program. And it needs this constant cycle of defying and humiliating the United States. You know, so to normalize or even to significantly improve relations with Washington would be to render North Korea superfluous as a separate Korean state. You know, the logic is just so simple and so inescapable that I have a hard time understanding why nobody in Washington will even talk about it. I think we just persist always in looking at diplomacy in personal terms. And I'm afraid that this humanitarian visit is only going to exacerbate that tendency.
You talk about the humanitarian mission. North Korea doesn't make any distinction then between a humanitarian mission and a political mission as such.
Well, you know, I think it's important for the North Korean media that this visit be portrayed to the North Korean people as not having been motivated by the desire to rescue those two women. As we heard from Evan Ranstad in his description of how the North Korean newspaper is handling this, they are presenting Bill Clinton's visit as having been more or less inspired by a desire to come and pay tribute to Pyongyang. The North Koreans love it when former adversaries come back to the now nuclearized North Korea and respectfully pay homage to the great leader, to the dear leader, I'm sorry. And now, of course, they're talking about the journalists having been let go, but I think that's being presented as a goodwill gesture on Kim Jong-il's part and not as a quid pro quo.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the Obama administration's decision to send former President Bill Clinton on a private mission to North Korea to free two American journalists and just maybe lay the groundwork for some new diplomacy with the so-called Hermit Kingdom. My guest this hour in Busan, South Korea, is Brian Myers. He's head of the International Studies Department at Dongseo University in Busan and an expert on North Korean ideology and propaganda. I'd like now to bring another voice into the conversation. Michael Crowley joins me from New York City. He is senior editor at The New Republic, and his article, The Decider, is an in-depth look at how the Obama foreign policy team has been performing on the world stage. Michael Crowley, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you see this mission by former President Clinton to North Korea?
Well, I think that it worked out very well. I mean, you do have to be careful about seeming to reward hostage-taking. It's important not to lose sight that this is an extremely nasty regime and that, you know, this is not some great act of generosity. I mean, there's a kind of heartwarming quality to it, but we have to remember that at base this was a really wicked thing that happened. But I think that it's a small triumph for the Obama administration, and I think that it, you know, does go to the core of what Obama is trying to do, which is to set a new tone, which is to say that we are going to engage with people, even those people we see as bad guys, to reverse the sort of general diplomatic course of the Bush administration, although even the Bush administration changed a little bit in its late years, but to open up a new period of engagement, diplomacy, and trying to be creative in solving these problems. I think we're still a long way from solving the problem of North Korea, but I think that, you know, it's a small step forward because the last point I would make is that up until now, North Korea had really confounded the Obama team. I think they were making pretty good progress on some other fronts, but this is one where I think they felt pretty boxed in. So a kind of a game changer really couldn't hurt from their perspective.
Well, you mentioned at the top rewarding hostage taking. I mean, I'm curious what kind of precedent does this set in a new administration for other countries around the world who are holding Americans? I mean, how might Iran see right. this? They're holding a couple of Americans right now who crossed over into their borders.
Yes, I think that that is the dark cloud that hovers over this. This is also the kind of conservative attack on what has happened. John Bolton, a former very hawkish Bush administration official, has been kind of hammering away at this in the last 24 hours or so, saying that the Obama administration is essentially inviting our enemies to seize hostages and then force us to kind of kowtow to them. I think the reality is that when another country is holding Americans prisoner, there's not that much we can do. There are times when your enemies have leverage over you and you have to find a way to make a concession possibly at minimal cost. And I would say we can talk about this at greater length. A nuclear bomb is actually sort of the great ultimate example of that sort of leverage. And I think ultimately to get North Korea to disarm, that may come at a much greater cost than simply the kind of photo op we saw having to do with a couple of hostages. So it's really all about leverage. And in this case, they had it. But I don't see from what we know that Obama gave away anything of great substance.
You talk about a small triumph here for the Obama administration, setting a new tone, a new period of engagement and diplomacy. In this piece that you wrote in the New Republic, this look at the Obama foreign policy team, generally speaking, how they've performed so far. I mean, what does this say for them about how they're going to handle these kinds of situations moving forward?
Well, again, I think that I would say, first of all, that I think they have run foreign policy pretty well, particularly in contrast to former President Clinton. When he came to office, he was not particularly interested in or engaged with foreign policy, to the point where his first national security advisor sent him a memo essentially complaining that he had to take it more seriously and couldn't just kind of box it off while he focused on the economy. I think a lot of people thought Obama might be too distracted by the economy to focus too much on foreign policy, but he really has been extremely engaged, down to the point, as I report in my story, of writing talking points, helping Joe Biden write talking points on Iran for a Sunday show. So the first point is that Obama is extremely engaged. The second point is that I do think they want to be creative, that they want to kind of break out of the box and the stereotypes of how America conducts itself in the world that were set in the Bush administration. And generally, I think they've been successful. They've put a great emphasis on keeping their team in line, making sure that there's not infighting, making sure that everyone's voices are heard. They have nothing if not endless successions of meetings where everyone is heard. So they've run a pretty smooth process. So I think that bodes well for how they handle North Korea going forward. Unfortunately, the bottom line is that the North Koreans have nuclear weapons. It's extremely hard to get people to give up nuclear weapons once they have them, because nuclear weapons are the sort of ultimate political diplomatic leverage. And once you give them up, you don't have that leverage anymore. And so I don't think they've figured out a solution to that.
Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking on NBC's Today Show this morning. She cautioned that her husband's trip was separate from official negotiations with North Korea over its nuclear program. But she said she still hoped that the mission might improve relations.
But I want to be sure people don't confuse what Bill did, which was a private humanitarian mission to bring these young women home, with our policy, which continues to be one that gives choices to North Korea. They can continue on the path they are on, or perhaps they will now be willing to start talking to us within the context of the six-party talks about the international desire to see them denuclearized.
Can there be separation between a denuclearized North Korea, or the hope for one, and this humanitarian mission, Michael Crowley?
Well, I think so. I mean, the North Koreans have now given up their smaller point of leverage, which is these hostages, and gotten their propaganda coup. And now the debate continues on the larger track about their nuclear program. And I think that it's interesting to hear the Secretary emphasize there the six-party talks. There were actually direct talks at the end of the Bush administration, when Christopher Hill, who was George Bush's envoy to North Korea, actually went and met with the North Koreans and cut a deal with them, which pretty quickly fell apart, to remove them from our list of terrorist state sponsors. But mm-hmm. What she's saying here is, we will talk to you, but it will be in a multilateral way. And I think, you know, the Obama administration is making it clear that at the same time, they're trying to establish their own leverage, which is to crack down, have the toughest sanctions possible against North Korea, isolate them and make them an international pariah, and give them that choice that she referred to. I mean, that's the key. When you talk to someone, you have to do it from your own position of leverage. So while they kind of feel out the possibility of negotiation, they have to maintain very strong diplomacy with our allies around the world, particularly with China, to show the North Koreans that if they don't talk to us, they're going to be very isolated, they're going to be very restricted, and hope that that will convince them to come to the table.
Brian Myers, jump in here. Will former President Clinton's visit be seen as condoning North Korea's recent behavior, this missile testing and such, while continuing moving forward to isolate them in these efforts?
Well, it will certainly be seen by North Korea as a show of weakness. One of the main things that their propaganda constantly reiterates about the United States is that America talks big, but when push comes to shove, it backs down. And we've seen a perfect example of this just in the past few weeks. I mean, what was it, 2 weeks ago we had Hillary Clinton saying that she would not pay any attention to the North Koreans unless they changed their ways. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, she sends her own husband to Pyongyang. So I think this is going to confirm the North Koreans in their belief that they can continue to defy the United States with impunity. As far as they see it, ever since they took the USS Pueblo in 1968, they have been humiliating the United States, beating the United States, defying America in every way, and never been punished for it. And I think this is going to make it all the more difficult for us to negotiate with them without resorting to military force.
So do you believe conflict is inevitable? Some sort of, well, use the word war, is that inevitable?
Well, what we need to realize, and what nobody in Washington seems to want to realize, is that the regime cannot possibly climb down from this nuclear pedestal and remain in power. As soon as North Korea normalizes or even improves drastically its relationship with the United States, it loses all reason to exist as a separate Korean state. This is all it has left. I think part of the problem here is the common American misperception that we're dealing with a communist state or a Stalinist state which can conceivably go back to its communist business without nuclear weapons. But that's not the case. This is a country that is very far removed from a communist state. This is a country with a race theory, with a race-based ideological antagonism to the United States. And this is really all they have left. So I do think that some kind of conflict is inevitable. We can give them choices, but, you know, you can bully a regime into making concessions, but you cannot bully or cajole a regime into committing political suicide. And that's what disarmament would mean for North Korea.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Mitchell Reese is joining us from Aspen, Colorado. He's a diplomat in residence at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He's held several top diplomatic positions in the George W. Bush administration. Mr. Reese has extensive experience negotiating with North Korea, including chief negotiator for the United States in the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization in the Clinton administration. Mitchell Reese, welcome to On Point. Glad you're with us.
Thank you.
So the Obama administration called former President Bill Clinton's visit solely private. Critics say this was more than that, going as far as to say a propaganda coup for the North Korean regime. How do you see it, sir?
Well, I think that it clearly was a coup for the North Korean regime, and I associate myself with all the comments that Brian Myers has just made. This was an achievement for Kim Jong-il along the lines of what his father did with bringing Jimmy Carter to Pyongyang a decade or so ago. So this is extremely important for the regime. It plays out very well domestically because of the propaganda organs, and it probably plays well into this transition that we're seeing slowly taking place in the North.
Did the Clinton visit in any way undermine, does it undermine broader U.S. interests moving forward, to your mind?
No, I really don't think so. And here is where I think Secretary Clinton is trying to do the right thing by distinguishing between a humanitarian visit clearly taken under duress. Every president, no matter what party, would behave in a similar fashion and has in the past when Americans are taken under these circumstances. And to try to distinguish that from the very real, very serious, and very deep differences that we continue to have with this North Korean regime.
You also, you do disagree with Brian Myers in that conflict is not necessarily inevitable, that negotiations can get us somewhere with North Korea.
I don't think that conflict is inevitable if you mean the outbreak of a major war. I think that there is still going to be a long period of very difficult and high tension between our two countries because of fundamental disagreements. The North Koreans have a proven nuclear weapons capability. As people have said earlier, it's very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult for countries to roll that back. And if the goal is regime preservation, then the calculation is, do nuclear weapons make me safer, or does getting rid of them and having a different relationship with the United States make me safer? And I think what we're seeing from North Korea, at least since the May nuclear test, is that they want both. They want to keep the nuclear weapons, or at least some small portion of them, and have better relations with the United States. And I think it's on that basis they've made clear they're willing to go forward in dialogue with America.
Just continue with that a little bit, Mitchell Reese. Going forward, North Korea announced it's withdrawn from the six-party talks, these long-running negotiations with the U.S., China, Russia, Japan, North and South Korea. What do you see in terms of those talks and the future of those?
Well, that's exactly right. And they have said they have no interest in returning to that particular diplomatic framework. The talks are dead, at least for the foreseeable future. What they have said instead is that they would like to have bilateral dialogue with the United States on the basis of equality. And they've made that clear that that means that the Obama administration would have to recognize the North as a nuclear weapons state. And the Obama administration, at least so far, has said that that's unacceptable.
Let's get a call in here from Oakland, Iowa. Carl is on the line. Carl, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. My point is that these two women went against the advice of everybody who even knew that they were out there. going into a regime where they knew that the possibility of imprisonment or death crossing that border was very real, they ignored all that in an attempt to gain some sort of personal credibility as journalists and to catapult their careers forward. And I think it was extremely stupid of the current administration to dispatch anybody to bail out these people who displayed just extreme stupidity and arrogance in trying to enter into that closed state.
All right, Carl, thank you. Brian Myers, would you respond to the caller? This is, you know, these women, he says, took a personal risk. It shouldn't be risk. We shouldn't risk American prestige to go in and save them.
Well, I would be inclined to agree with Carl on that. I mean, I don't want to, you know, and the women have gone through so much in the past 4 months, and I'm sure they've learned their lesson. On the other hand, I think we need to realize that this incident is not something that we can simply encapsulate and take out of the whole negotiation process. This is going to, you know, teach the North Koreans how to behave with us. And I think we may well live to see that the humanitarian benefits of getting these two women out of the country were not equal to the danger, the increased danger of military conflict that will come about because they no longer take our word seriously.
Here's another call from Michael. He's in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, interesting discussion. So I have two questions. One is you mentioned the coverage in North Korea. Very different from here, and I was wondering what the coverage in China is. My other thing is I'm fascinated by the kind of cult of personalities on both sides. I mean, we have Kim Il-jung, or whatever the name is, on one side and playing his kind of chess game, and we have the two Clintons. One is Secretary of State, who has been kind of sidelined a little by all the economic stuff here and very ambitious, Obama and Bill Clinton, who is, you know, never wanted to shy away from world stage. And I'm just wondering whether how much of this was kind of forced on Obama and how much is it that, as people discussed before, it's a reflection of his policy. I'm wondering what the personality issues behind the scene are in Washington.
Michael, thank you. Brian Myers, I'll let you respond to the second point first. For time reasons, I know you have to go. Go ahead.
Well, I would rather respond to the coverage issue. I'm not sure
okay.
how it's being covered in China, but if I could just add a point that's been missing here. The North Koreans are claiming in their media that Bill Clinton passed on a message, an oral message from Obama
right,
to Kim Jong-il.
A personal message, yeah.
And this is something that of course, Washington is denying, but this is very important to how it's being depicted in North Korea. As for the other question, I think that one of the other guests is probably better able to handle that than me.
Well, Brian Myers, I know you have to jump off. I will ask Michael Crowley and Mitchell Reese about Team Clinton after the break. I appreciate your time, though, sir. Thank you very much. Brian
Perfect.
Myers from Busan,
Bye-bye.
South Korea. Bye-bye. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Bill Clinton's mission to Pyongyang and what it means for our North Korea diplomacy, what it says about how the Obama administration's handling is of big world problems. My guest this hour, Michael Crowley, senior editor at The New Republic, and Mitchell Reese, diplomat in residence at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He has extensive experience as a top negotiator with the North Korean government. Here's President Obama speaking today shortly after President Clinton and the freed journalist, the two women, touched down in Burbank, California.
Not only is this White House obviously extraordinarily happy, but all Americans should be grateful to both former President Clinton and Vice President Gore for their extraordinary work. My hope is that the families that have been reunited can enjoy the next several days and weeks, understanding that because of the efforts of President Clinton and Gore, they are able to be with each other once again.
President Obama speaking this morning. Michael Crowley, let me turn to you for a moment and have you dig deeper a little bit on Obama foreign policy. Before the break, the caller asked, you know, what does this say about Hillary Clinton, Team Clinton, Bill Clinton back in the saddle now? I mean, how does the former president's actions, what does they say about the Secretary of State? Does it marginalize Hillary Clinton in any way, or does it show that the power couple's back?
I think the latter. I think it shows that the power couple is back. I think it shows actually a level of confidence on the part of everyone involved, that President Obama doesn't feel threatened by Bill Clinton taking a prominent role like this, that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton seem able to work in tandem on a complicated, sensitive issue like this, that the three of them are working in tandem. You know, I was surprised when Obama chose Hillary to be his Secretary of State. The presidential campaign was such a psychodrama. There were all these kind of ancillary issues and resentments and unresolved, you know, grievances between them. And I'm amazed at how well it's worked out. I mean, there has been some narrative in the press about her being sidelined and so forth, shut out. I think that's overstated. I think that what she's been doing is reminiscent of what she did when she went to the New York Senate in 2000. She was kind of a celebrity from her years in the White House, and really just put her head down and worked hard and didn't try to attract a lot of attention, tried to establish her credibility. Workhorse, not a show horse, was sort of the cliched phrase to describe it. But I think we're seeing that model again. The last point I would make is I think that this is, of course, not the most important thing that's happened here, but a real redemption for Bill Clinton, who had one of the most sterling reputations in all politics before the 2008 presidential campaign. Here was a man who, you know, had left office under clouds of scandal, went on to start this foundation that did good works all over the world, seemed to be rising above politics, was a kind of a man of you know, bringing good health and peace around the world, really diminished that reputation during the campaign with his tirades, with comments that people thought might be racially charged, and now is back in this place, I think, where he kind of had been before, where he was sort of a global leader who was doing good deeds, who was somewhat above the fray. So I think for Bill, this is kind of a redemption that he's been looking for.
Mitchell Reese, you've worked in two administrations. How do you see Obama foreign policy right now, and how do you, what do you make of Bill Clinton being used in this way by the Obama administration?
Well, I agree. I think it's a measure of self-confidence that they would let the former president do this, but the family did request him specifically. And let's be very clear, this deal was pre-cooked in New York before the president, the ex-president, ever stepped foot on the plane to go to Pyongyang. So it's not as if this was a remarkable diplomatic achievement. This was a result of weeks, if not months, of negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea quietly in order to liberate these two young women. More broadly, the administration has only been in office about 6 months, and so I think that we all tend to give report cards a little bit too quickly. They need time to get settled in. They still don't even have all their senior people in place. They're facing an extraordinary array of problems, from the financial crisis to climate change. I think that they've made a number of missteps with the Russians, with the Middle East peace process. On Iran, there's been some misstatements by the Vice President and Secretary Clinton. But it's still early days, and, you know, we're just going to have to keep on watching carefully.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones to Rochester, Minnesota. Jay's on the line. Jay, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. You know, the Chinese symbol for crisis and opportunity are the same, and this story illustrates that, in that some negative motives on the part of various people have turned out very well. Kim Jong-il had some personal political negative motives. The journalists trying to further their career at the possible expense of their country, negative motives. Bill Clinton, perhaps a negative motive to further his own career, although ex-presidents are excellent unofficial ambassadors of their country, as Jimmy Carter has demonstrated. Mm-hmm. And so to save two lives and to put a crack in the light of possible non-belligerent communication with North Korea, the whole thing turned out amazingly well.
You're very positive about it. Jay, thank you. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Georgia. She's in Sharon, Massachusetts. Georgia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
I'm Korean-American. I came here, like, you know, 16 years ago. I think Obama administration did a wonderful, wonderful job where I see it, and that they know how to deal with North Korea, and they died to recognize Biden-American, so went there and did. I think it's a wonderful, marvelous job, my viewpoint. I know there is a watch, everything, and they made a mistake. But my point of view, they did a wonderful job, and I really, really applaud for them, and I really appreciate the bottom of the in heart as a Korean American save the humanitarian point, not the political anything. I really listen to the comment off the there. Thank you.
All right,
so
Georgia.
Much.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your call. You know, there's a question I had after speaking with Evan Rumstad at the top of the hour in South Korea. He mentioned that there are several other Americans still being held in North Korea. Michael Crowley, Mitchell Reese. I mean, is this a matter of these are two more high-profile cases? I mean, North Korea could get something out of them. You know, Lisa Ling, an American journalist, quite high-profile. There was a lot of attention paid to this. I mean, there are still others that are there that are not getting the same attention. Michael Crowley?
Well, I would defer to Mitchell on this. I'm not aware of other Americans who are being held in North Korea. I believe there are South Koreans who are being held, and there are some Americans who are being held in Iran. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. But, you know, I think that the larger point holds, which is that you have to be very careful about rewarding the taking of kidnappers. I mean, this goes back, for instance, to the plague of kidnappings in Lebanon in the 1980s that ultimately led to the Iran-Contra fiasco. But the reality is you can't change the fact that kidnapping does give bad people leverage. And I think most of us are not prepared to just let people rot in prisons. So you end up having to give up a concession.
Hmm. Mitchell Reese?
No, I think it's very useful to remind people of the really odious nature of this regime. And yes, South Koreans are being held in the North. North Korea has still not given a full accounting of South Koreans who were captured as POWs from the Korean War. So you have to understand with the people you're dealing with here. Now, if you want to get these two young women out, in one sense, you are rewarding bad behavior. Brian Myers talked about that a little bit earlier. The reality is the United States has been rewarding North Korea's bad behavior for far too long. So this really is just a minor little hiccup in a long-running story, and it is a challenge for the administration. How are they going to be able to change the incentive structure for the North Koreans so that they don't engage in provocative behavior, because that's paid off for them in the past?
What about China and its ability now to influence events in North Korea, especially after this particular incident? Does this change anything on that front, Mitchell Reese?
No, I really don't think it does. The Chinese always come to us saying that they don't have nearly as much influence as we think they do. The reality is that about 80% of the energy and food assistance that North Korea gets comes across that border with China. So the Chinese do have leverage. It's just a question of whether they're willing to use it. And I think we've seen since the second nuclear test in May of this year and the ballistic missile tests and the ongoing belligerence from Pyongyang that the Chinese have been much more willing to actually squeeze the regime. We've seen some investment opportunities that the Chinese had in North Korea being withdrawn. They've stepped up border patrols and custom searches. So I think all this is a very good thing, and I think that was the context against which the release of these two young women took place.
You mentioned,
and if I can just jump
please,
in,
Michael,
Jane,
go ahead.
I think, you know, just you could do an entire show on China and the role it plays in American foreign policy more generally. It is so important on so many of the hardest questions Obama faces. China plays a key role in trying to pressure Iran. Any sanctions regime that we're going to try to potentially apply to Iran if negotiations with their nuclear program fail in the fall and winter. Global warming, needless to say, the global economic crisis. China's cooperation on all these fronts is essential. The problem is that on a lot of these issues, we don't have that much leverage with China. To some extent, we're really trying to convince them through the power of persuasion to be more aligned with our own foreign policy, but their interests are very different from ours, and in many ways, of course, we're rivals. So China is a huge problem for the Obama administration to manage.
Let's go to Midway, Georgia. Terry is waiting on the line. Welcome to On Point, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I respectfully disagree with your guest as far as Bill Clinton having a sterling reputation. In my opinion, and I'll take my response off the air, in my opinion, Bill Clinton has a terrible reputation. He took integrity out of the office of the White House, and Bush administration put it back. He put the integrity back in the White House to the world. Now, I'm not saying that Bush didn't make his mistakes. I know he did, and there's probably some that I don't even know about. But either way, I do like the Bush administration. And as far as I am glad that the hostages are home. That's, I am really very, very happy about that, pleased about that for the families. As far as North Korea, Pyongyang, he dangled these hostages in front of the United States to try to keep him in the forefront of just keeping everybody's mind,
mm-hmm.
and he's showing the world that he can push the United States around. In my opinion, I think that we should leave North Korea to themselves. If they want to create a nuclear arsenal, let them go ahead.
All right, Terry.
It's none of our business. And as far as China and Iran and North Korea are working in tandem, and as far as China goes, I'm not sure, but I don't think Obama has any clout as far as foreign relations at all. And I appreciate
Terry,
my comment.
I appreciate your calling. Thank you very much. Pyongyang playing us for dummies. Michael Crowley, Terry's point.
Well, first of all, I would say that leaving North Korea alone, let them be. It sounds nice. The problem is that they are proliferating nuclear technology to Syria, possibly to Burma. That's really what's most terrifying. I don't worry that North Korea is going to try to nuke the United States. I worry that they're going to try to make some money by selling nuclear technology, information, material to other countries. Maybe it gets in the hands of terrorists. That's what worries me. To the point that the world perceived George W. Bush to have more integrity in the Oval Office than Bill Clinton, I think, is absolutely demonstrably false. America's reputation around the world completely plunged. It did severe damage to American interests. The perceptions of Bush around the world did severe damage to American interests. And I as I recall, generally speaking, internationally, a lot of people around the world didn't see what the big deal was about Bill Clinton's sexual transgressions, and America's reputation was terrific when he left office. So I just think that's demonstrably false.
Mitchell Reese, let me ask you a little bit more about Obama foreign policy. You mentioned some missteps so far as it relates to the Middle East and Iran. What do you hope to see this foreign policy team do moving forward?
Well, there are so many issues on the agenda. I think job number one has to be coming to grips with the global financial crisis. The American stimulus package is going to basically run its course by the end of this year, early next year. We have to make sure that there's not a double dip, that there's not a recourse to what we experienced over the past year. So we are going to have to lead the world out of this recession. We're going to have to set up new rules. These are being discussed. We have to make sure that these rules are friendly for the American style of capitalism going forward, or else we're going to be living in a much less prosperous world. That's number one. Number two is the issue of climate change. It's coming up this December in Copenhagen. This is enormously complicated, and as Michael said, we are going to need buy-in from countries that don't see this issue the same way we do, particularly China and India. We need both countries' help, not just China. We need India's help on Iran also, because India provides an awful lot of refined petroleum products to Iran, so they have leverage. Afghanistan is not going terribly well right now. We still have 130,000 troops in Iraq. We need to unwind that according to the pace of stability there, and at the same time reassure the region that we're not just leaving them to the tender mercies of the Iranians. So there's a number of challenges out there. It's unclear right now exactly what the strategy of the administration is. We hear the Secretary of State talk about smart power. At best, that's a tactic. That's a means to some larger end. At worst, it's just a slogan. So I think we're still trying to understand what's the vision for the United States and for the world that the President and the Secretary of State have. And I don't think we've heard that yet.
Michael Crowley, you wrote this piece in the New Republic called The Decider, Who Runs U.S. Foreign Policy. Would you answer Mitchell Reese's question? What is the strategy of Obama foreign policy? What is the vision as you see it, as you've reported on it?
Well, you know, the point of the piece, I guess, that I wrote was to say that Barack Obama is dramatically confident and engaged in the making of American foreign policy, which may sound intuitive, except that in his early months, George Bush was not, and Bill Clinton most decidedly was not. Actually, Bill Clinton managed to make a hash of things in his first few months. I think that as far as a philosophy and an overarching vision, it's true. It's a work in power, a work in progress, and smart power is still being defined. But it's clearly, again, engagement, diplomacy, trying to trying to capitalize on the sheer change of direction of American foreign policy toward a willingness to talk to people whom we had excluded for a long time, and frankly, to capitalize on a sense of goodwill and trust that people have in Barack Obama. I mean, to some extent, American foreign Barack Obama's foreign policy is Barack Obama. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, that that really defines a lot of what we're doing right now.
Well, many thanks to both of my guests, all of my guests this hour. A really interesting conversation. Mitchell Crowley is in New York. He's senior editor at The New Republic. His most recent article, The Decider, looks at Obama foreign policy. Thanks to you, Michael.
Thank you so much.
And Mitchell Reese, he's diplomat in residence at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, has held several top diplomatic positions in the George W. Bush administration. I appreciate your time today. Mitchell, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.